Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I know there's a lot of interest in reports from the Middle East overnight. We do not have any comment at this time.
The White House hasn't shied away much from commenting during this conflict, so silence from Washington after an Israeli strike on Iran could be strategic, an effort to further de-escalate. Israel, too, isn't saying anything about the attack, and in Iran, it's being downplayed, possibly another sign of stepping back from the abyss. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Tom Harrington. It's Friday, April 19th, coming up on 6 Eastern Time, also on the podcast.
It's not just Cowley, it's all of Alberta that's suffering. People have had to sell off herds, had to downsize.
Saving water and livelihoods in Alberta. After a dry winter and ahead of severe drought expected this summer, the province has a plan to cut back on water use. And their owners have always treated them like family. Now, a landmark dog custody case reconsiders how pets are viewed in the eyes of the law. Israel and Iran appear to have pulled back from the brink of an all-out war. Neither side is providing the details of what exactly happened overnight, but Iran claims it repelled a modest Israeli counterattack that may have involved only a handful of drones. As Chris Brown reports from Jerusalem, observers believe the two enemies have decided that's enough for now.
The booms in the pre-dawn sky near the city of Isfahan signaled Iran's air defenses had detected an incoming attack and fired to intercept. But it all appeared to be over quickly. Soon after, an amateur video was posted showing people at the nearby high-value nuclear facility at work saying everything appeared to be fine and secure.
Triggered by the presence of three small drones.
The no damage done messaging was repeated on state television, reporting that the intruders were shot down.
Nothing has happened. Everything is back to normal.
Iran's claims are impossible to verify, and Israel has not claimed responsibility or commented at all on the attack. But if that was its response, it represented a tiny fraction of the firepower Iran unleashed on Israel less than a week ago, when 300 projectiles required the combined efforts of Israel, Jordan, the U.S., and Britain to shoot almost all of them down. There's a consensus of opinion that Israel wanted to send a warning signal, and one that was carefully calculated to avoid escalation. In Jerusalem, some said they were disappointed.
I think more would have been even justified, considering they sent 300 rockets to kill so many people.
Dan Cintrinovich is a former Israeli military officer who was once in charge of gathering intelligence on Iran.
I think that in this case, maybe the tit for tat for now has ended.
But he says the incident has left Israel facing an emboldened Iran, and Israelis should now realize they need help from other countries to defend themselves.
Israel, we find it very hard to cope with the Iranian access alone. And I think we need our partners. Israel have to move, for example, regarding the Palestinian issue, in a way that it will ease the Gulf state, especially Saudi Arabia, to start normalization process with Israel.
With the threat of a direct attack from Iran apparently subsiding, Israel's focus will now likely swing back to its war with Hamas, where the Gaza Health Ministry says more than 34,000 people have been killed and 1.6 million people are displaced. People there wonder if a threatened invasion of crowded Rafah can be far off. Will Israel come from the ocean, from the east or the west, or by planes? No one knows anything, said Abdul Jabbar Araqwa. We have an indescribable fear. The feeling tonight is that neither Iran nor Israel wanted to escalate, and both had a mutual interest in stepping back. But with both sides still locked in the same struggle for dominance in the region, the fear is the pause could be temporary. Chris Brown, CBC News, Jerusalem.
Diplomats around the world have been urging restraint from Israel in the wake of Iran's attack last weekend. So today, there is a kind of collective relief at the outcome. But as Sasha Petrosik reports, Israel's allies know containing simmering tensions in the region will require a great deal of follow-up work.
The loudest reaction from Iran was on the streets of the capital, the kind of anti-Israel protest that's not uncommon here and always officially orchestrated. Placards saying, "Down with Israel," in English. But there were no calls for revenge from Iran's leaders, and that left world leaders to guess whether the crisis had passed. No one's owning up to it. No one knows, says Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan. Similarly, from British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
With the situation overnight, as you would appreciate, it's a developing situation. It wouldn't be right for me to speculate until the facts become clear.
The U.S. has been working hard to keep Israel from reacting strongly to last Saturday's attack by Iran, with many public and private warnings. Today, at a meeting of G7 ministers in Italy, Secretary of State Antony Blinken had much less to say.
The United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. What we're focused on, what the G7 is focused on, and again, it's reflected in our statement and in our conversation, is our work to de-escalate tensions.
Off the record, U.S. officials say they were told about Israel's move just before it happened. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said it's time to move on.
All agreed that everything needs to be done to prevent further escalation in the region, to get back on a track towards supporting people in the region.
Security analyst Mark Kansian calls it a minimalist compromise move by Israel, responding to U.S. pressure.
Enough to make the point to the Iranians that the Israelis can strike them when they need to, make a point that if the Iranians strike Israel again, Israel can strike them.
Most agree the rivalry between Iran and Israel, now out in the open, has changed the Mideast, with Arab nations taking clear sides, with Israeli observers like Uzi Rabi from Tel Aviv University seeing an anti-Iran coalition.
And this coalition is very, very important in order to create kind of a geopolitical structure in the Middle East that should be reckoned with from now on.
But the danger isn't over, says analyst Aaron David Miller.
The real problem now, I think, is that the strategic competition between Iran and Israel is going to continue. We are not by any means out of the proverbial woods. Perhaps on this phase, yes, but not over time.
The conflict may move back into the shadows, but the prospect of all-out fighting remains. Sasha Petrosik, CBC News, Washington.
Coming right up, Alberta is taking big steps to protect its water supply. With a severe drought expected this summer, the province has a plan to cut back. Plus, it's like the Super Bowl for Taylor Swift fans. The pop star's new album is out, and it comes with a big surprise. Later, how artificial intelligence is not just changing the world, it is changing the world of sports. The Alberta government is preparing for yet another year of drought. Today, it announced an unprecedented new agreement to reduce water use in the South Saskatchewan River Basin. That includes the areas around the Bow, Old Man, and Red Deer Rivers. But it's still not clear if the conservation plan will be needed or even how much it will help. Joel Dryden explains.
I mean, if we get another dry year here, who knows what's going to happen to a lot of people and a lot of their farms.
That's Edward Dinkerville, who has a farm near the village of Cowley in southern Alberta. Last year, he had to haul water in order to keep his animals hydrated.
I mean, it's not just Cowley, it's all of Alberta that's suffering. People have had to sell off herds, had to downsize.
With the risk of severe drought high this summer because of low snowpack and already low river and reservoir levels, the Alberta government has announced a significant new plan to conserve water in the semi-arid southern part of the province.
This is the largest water sharing agreement in Alberta's history. And of course, this puts us in a position where we are ready to respond if we are, in fact, in a significant drought later this year.
But Alberta Environment Minister Rebecca Schultz says it will only be triggered if conditions get too dire. If the snow melt and water levels are too low, participating municipalities have agreed to reduce water use by between 5 and 10%. Alberta's largest city is part of the plan. But this afternoon, Calgary's adaptation manager Nicole Newton said they're hoping that can be done without asking residents to limit their indoor water use.
Our biggest opportunity is in really reducing that outdoor water use. Our demands increase by 20 to 30% in the outdoor watering season, and that is where we would be asking Calgarians to reduce.
Industrial operators and farming irrigation districts have also agreed to reduce their water use, but the agreements are all voluntary.
They'll stick to them, I'm sure.
Evan Davies is a water resources expert at the University of Alberta.
It does make you wonder, however, what will happen in future years if the drought continues or if it worsens.
Davies says the biggest farm irrigators in the province have water licenses dating back decades, and some have already agreed to cut back water use significantly.
And asking them, you know, year after year to take 50% reductions when legally they have the right to withdraw up to their licensed allocation is asking them to take quite a large hit. But it's not clear to me what the alternative would be.
The environment minister says the province is trying to modernize Alberta's water licensing system and more.
Are we encouraging water conservation? Are there ways that we could do better?
A difficult balancing act as the province tries to protect its people and its precious water resources. Joel Dryden, CBC News, Calgary.
Canada's premiers have written to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, urging him to rethink parts of his new budget. They say Ottawa is infringing in their areas of jurisdiction and setting up new programs with no long-term plan to sustain them. They also say outreach to provinces and territories ahead of the budget was limited. At an event in Victoria, Trudeau said some provinces don't match the federal government's ambitions.
I'm going to work where I can in partnership with provinces that want to, like BC and others have, and places where they want to block the kinds of investments that are going to help Canadians. I'm just going to try and figure out ways to help Canadians directly as necessary. I'd always rather work with provinces, but if we have to, I will go around them and be there for Canadians.
The Alberta government has already said it will pass a new law banning Ottawa from negotiating directly with its city governments. Quebec already has a similar law. A golden retriever named Stella is now part of legal history in British Columbia. An upper court decided who would take care of her using new provincial laws recognizing pets as family members and not just property. As the CBC's Tanya Fletcher tells us, the case sets a precedent that could have an impact across the country.
Stella, look. Come on, come on.
Sahar Bayat is overjoyed to be reunited with her dog, Stella, after spending the last 10 months in legal limbo.
It was a long process. It was very lengthy, very costly.
A nurse from Surrey, she and her partner got Stella as a puppy in 2020. Last year, they split up. Bayat says her ex kept Stella because it was his name on the dog's certificate.
I couldn't bear the pain of not having her. She was a huge part of my life. We spent 24/7 together.
Several months later, it would become the first case of its kind to go before the BC Supreme Court. Through her lawyers and $60,000 in legal fees, Bayat fought for sole custody of Stella. But in the end, the judge ordered joint custody. Stella would be split evenly on a weekly basis.
I'm very, very thankful for the new law because, you know, these days dogs are just like kids. They are my kids and I will fight tooth and nail for them.
The court decision comes 3 months after Premier David Eby announced updates to BC's Family Law Act, now recognizing pets as members of the family.
There will be changes made to ensure that pets are not treated as simply property, that their special place in the family is considered by the courts.
So we're giving a voice to animals in the court, which we haven't seen before.
Victoria Schroff is a lawyer who specializes in animal rights and has been pushing for these changes. She says before it was simply whoever owns the pet gets to keep the pet. Now the courts will consider 8 relational factors under the new legislation.
Who's the better owner going to be in the circumstances? So looking at things, for example, like the bond between a child and the family pet and who really took care of the animal, not just who bought the animal.
She says BC is the first to pass such legislation, and other provinces have since approached her to help bring in similar laws elsewhere.
Good dog.
As for Bayat,
it was all worth it. It was all worth it. Honestly, I would do it all over again for her.
Tanya Fletcher, CBC News, Surrey, BC.
There you go.
All 12 jurors and 6 alternates have been chosen for Donald Trump's trial in Manhattan. The former president is in court for failing to properly account for payments his lawyer made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. The alleged transactions took place before the 2016 election to keep their affairs secret. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. He has denied any wrongdoing. The trial is scheduled to start on Monday. Starting today, tens of millions of people in India are casting their ballots. India's democracy is so big, it takes 6 weeks to run their national election. Political observers say Prime Minister Narendra Modi is widely expected to secure a rare third term in office. South Asia correspondent Salima Shivji breaks down what's at stake for Indian voters.
The lines grow as the day wears on in India's north. For this, the first of 7 phases of voting in the biggest election the world has ever seen. It's my duty to vote, Salma Dilshad says, or else nothing changes. One family arrived at their polling booth minutes before it closed, 15 members strong, with a singular purpose. The Prime Minister Narendra Modi is the best, the matriarch Shobha Jain says. He'll get a massive majority. It's a common thread at polling stations here in Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state, with more people living here than in countries like Brazil or Pakistan. The state sends the most MPs to India's parliament, and it's right in the country's Hindi heartland, where Narendra Modi is very popular. It feels good to have voted, this 28-year-old says.
Who do you think is the best leader for India right now?
Narendra Modi.
If you believe the polls, Modi is looking to cruise to a rare third term as prime minister. There's a frenzied devotion at his rallies, a religious fervor with many of his supporters comparing the politician to a god. Modi, our god, has done very good work, this man says.
Especially Hinduism, strong Hinduism.
Modi's Hindu nationalist agenda resonates deeply in many parts of the country, even as his critics charge he's targeting India's minorities and eroding its secular constitution. Modi also often leans into an economic agenda, praising India's fast-growing economy. But some say it's a hollow message, with inequality deepening and unemployment high among the young. That pain is felt on the outskirts of Delhi, where laborers wait desperately every morning to be hired for a casual day's work. Naresh Mahatu sends the meager money he makes to his family, 2 states away. What has the Modi government done for the poor? Nothing, he says. Others, like Naveen Ranga, waiting nearby and also unemployed, fear further divisions. All Modi has done is divide Hindus and Muslims. That's how he works. But even with some discontent, most see the opposition banded together in a fragmented alliance as facing an uphill battle in this election against a very popular, if polarizing, prime minister. Salima Shivji, CBC News, Muzaffarnagar, Uttar Pradesh.
Artificial intelligence is transforming the world, including the world of sports. Today, Olympic organizers shared their plans for the new technology at the upcoming Summer Games and beyond. They say it could do everything from making judge sports less controversial to scouting new talent around the world. Sam Sampson breaks down its many possibilities.
Kyle Shufelt twists through the air three times at his Calgary gym and lands with a smile. 20 years after his gold medal in gymnastics, and the passion is still there, as is the appreciation for specifics.
You have handstand positions. Are you 10 degrees off or 20 degrees off? There's a variance of deduction between those two things. So a human eye can't necessarily always detect that.
But artificial intelligence can. On Friday, the International Olympic Committee described several ways it's using AI at Paris 2024 and in the future.
The opportunities and capabilities that AI offers are far-reaching.
Beyond making it easier to broadcast the games around the world and building efficient venues, AI will be used during the events themselves as a judging tool. AI software can show, in real time, if an athlete's body hit a desired angle, how quickly a person was traveling, or how in sync a group performs. Quickly delivered information Shufelt believes could eliminate judging biases and errors.
If AI would have been used in 2004 in the vault competition, I think I would have won a bronze medal.
Along with the gold medal, Shufelt almost placed bronze in the vault that same year. A judge, however, gave an opponent who fell a higher score, a controversial decision that saw Shufelt place fourth.
I think that this is actually going to create a more even playing field. I would tell all young athletes this is actually something that we need to embrace.
This is something that's never been possible before.
AI is also being used to find future Olympians.
And those metrics identify talent.
The IOC held camps in Senegal, site of the upcoming Youth Olympics, and used software to help young athletes determine which sports they could succeed in. American skiing Olympian Lindsey Vonn says that data could be the seed of encouragement some athletes need early on.
I think especially with social media now and the way kids operate, you know, if they don't have some sort of instant knowledge, they move on really quickly, and I don't want to lose that next generation to video games. I hope that kids stay active in sports and that they still pursue the dream of being an Olympian. If AI helps them to acknowledge that their talent does exist, I think it's hugely beneficial.
The IOC didn't delve into cybersecurity concerns. That's an issue some worry could be exacerbated by increased use of AI. But officials did drive home one message. The use of AI in the Olympics is not meant to replace athletes. The humanity of the games, they say, will remain untouched. Sam Sampson, CBC News, Regina.
Taylor Swift's ability to dominate pop music and pop culture is showing no signs of easing up. The singer-songwriting superstar is in the middle of the highest-grossing music tour ever. Her every movement with her NFL superstar boyfriend is scrutinized, and her net worth topped $1 billion this month. Today, Swift released a surprise double album. And as Ivo Musa tells us, it's already smashing records.
Well, we definitely had a bit of a lineup this morning.
Chris Evers is standing in front of a large Taylor Swift display. He manages Sonic Boom, a record store in downtown Toronto that's seeing a steady stream of Swifties intent on buying her new record, titled The Tortured Poets Department.
She's definitely, you know, one of the top-selling vinyl artists for sure.
Evers says Swift's new album will likely be the store's biggest release of the year. And for a fortnight there, we
were forever one until you saw. I waited up all night to hear releases and keep on with TikTok and friends, and it was so exciting.
Even though the pop superstar released her latest music online at midnight, Chelsea Gibson says she had to have her own personal copy of the all-white vinyl album.
Would you like a bag today?
Yeah, that'd be great. Awesome.
The self-described superfan even wore her favorite Taylor Swift sweater to mark the occasion.
It makes it fun to have it in, like, by your hands, and you get that first, when it first clicks down, and you get the crackle, and then the first song. That's my favorite moment for any vinyl. All of this to
say, I hope you're okay. Fans knew the album was coming, but Swift surprised them overnight with an additional release, an extra 15 songs, making it a double album. The lyrics, like much of her other work, details heartbreak, giving fans a peek into the personal life of a very public performer.
I think, speaking as a woman, it's hard to get representation that is as diverse emotionally as she's covered. Little did you know your home's really
only a town you're just a guest in. Swift is known for being a prolific singer-songwriter. The 34-year-old has released 11 albums, most of them in the past 5 years. I need to forget, so take me to Florida. I've got some regrets, I'll bury them in Florida.
On
this latest venture, she's collaborated with artists like Florence and the Machine and Post Malone to deliver what music journalist Melissa Vincent says is a promise made to fans.
I think you see this real vulnerability, and of course that has been her hallmark over the years, but we also see Taylor Swift in present tense. So she's reflecting on the past, but there also are these really visceral responses to how she's experiencing her life today. And, you know, I think she's well aware that it's not necessarily Taylor as the underdog, it's Taylor as the supernova. You can
be the heat. According to Billboard magazine, Swift's new album is Spotify's most streamed album in a single day in 2024 so far, unseating the previous record holder, Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter, in less than 12 hours. Yet another milestone for the top recording artist in the world. Idil Moussa, CBC News, Toronto.
We'll close with a cat that came back, though not the very next day. This cat reappeared after 2 weeks and more than 1,500 kilometers.
How he has sustained himself in the last 2 weeks is another mystery. We have no idea, but it's an absolute miracle that he's here.
Here is Springbok PEI. Tony Diodati and Hugh Jones were moving there from Southern Ontario. It was a road trip to a new home. They had all their stuff, including two dogs and their cat, Riley. But then, a little mishap along the way. Somewhere at a rest stop in Ontario, the feline made a beeline. They wondered if Riley has 9 lives, has he run out? They even had a mechanic look under the hood.
But there was no sign of him, so we thought we'd lost him. 2 weeks later, he was sitting on the steps out in the backyard.
I said to him, "Are you Riley?" And he just looked at me, and then all of a sudden he went, meow.
Maybe that's cat chat for, "I've seen some things, man." It's still a bit of a mystery how Riley made it to their new island home. In the car's undercarriage? Maybe hitched a ride? Or did he come through in the clutch? In the end, the important part is, well, let's Fred take it.
The cat came back the very next day. The cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat...
Goner? Not a chance. He's still living the life of Riley. This has been Your World Tonight for Friday, April 19th. I'm Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening tonight. Stay safe and take care of each other.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.